I really want people to understand that they can report it at any time. And even if nothing happens for them, they might prevent someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Because my understanding is my perpetrator had many, many victims. Most,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, most he wasn't charged for.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, when I walked out of that police department, it was so weird. I had done so much therapy. I had done so much work. I had done so much counseling. But walking out of that police department, I was like, I just took my life back. I just took my life back.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real people share their real life experiences and the tools they have developed to move forward and live their best lives. I'm Jenny Taylor.
And I'm Michelle Scharf. Today we have with us Brandy Page. Brandy, I believe you reached out to the show to share your story. Somebody had recommended you share your story with us. And we got to talking and we discovered a different story. We may cover a couple stories with you in the future. But today we're going to focus on some really sensitive information. For those of our listeners listening in your car, if you have children with you, this is another in our three-part series on child sexual abuse. And the topic may cover some information that may be too difficult for a child to hear. So we just want you to be mindful of that when you're listening to this episode. So now that we got that business out of the way, Brandy, welcome to our show. How are you doing today?
Good. Nervous, but good.
Oh, you have nothing to be nervous. You're here with a bunch of girlfriends. It's coffee chat without the coffee.
Yep.
We're all drinking water.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about you.
So I am a wife and a mom. I have five kids. I have a girl, two boys, and then twin girls, my little caboose. And I work as a taxpayer advocate and take care of my kids, go to sports events all
the
time.
How old are your kids?
My daughter, my oldest, is 19. Then my son is 17. And then I have a 13-year-old son and 2 9-year-old daughters.
Oh, okay, cute.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun.
So those are busy ages when yes. They're just, like you said, sports or who knows what.
All yeah. Day, every day.
Yeah.
So we got to talking and you were actually going to come on to the show for a different topic. And then you called me back and you said, you know, instead of that one, I was really encouraged by my daughter to share this other story. Tell us, introduce that story to us. Why did your daughter feel like this would be a better story for you to share with us?
So my daughter had been interning at the Ogden Prosecutor's Office. And so she's seeing a lot of children, especially, that were coming in with sexual abuse and sexual violence. And I had wanted to tell my story for a really long time, just kind of trying to figure out the best avenue to do it, because mm-hmm. my life could be a book easily, and I didn't know what would be the best way to get it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was raped by my uncle when I was 8.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't ever tell anyone for quite a few years when it happened, because he threatened me not to. And he knew what to tell me. He knew exactly what to say. I have a deep love for my family, especially my aunt. He's my ex-uncle, I should say. Especially my aunt that he was married to. And he made sure I understood that, A, no one would believe me, and B, I would rip our family apart, is what he told me to keep me quiet.
Which is terrifying to a kid.
Terrifying.
That is what grooming
especially
is.
Especially after you've yes. been so violated. Like, it's not like you're in the strongest position of mind to say, no, don't tell me that. I mean, you've just been completely, as an 8-year-old,
mm-hmm.
I have a 10-year-old daughter. That's 2 years younger than her. That makes me sick to my stomach. I'm really, really sorry you had to go through that.
Yeah, I look at my kids. My oldest, Mackenzie, she saved my life. I got pregnant with her. I had her at 19. And I was in a really dark place when I had her, still trying to unpack what had happened to me. Because a lot of people don't realize, if you haven't been there, And in my experience, particularly men, the toll that it takes long after the night of what happened to you.
Right.
And I realize that everybody is different and the way that they remember things and stuff is different. I personally have a photographic memory, so I could be touched the wrong way and I could go right back to like I was in that room. I could see that room around me. I could see the wood-burning fireplace. I could see the banana chair like that. I mean, and
right,
it would
all
be
the details.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wish I didn't. My mom is completely the opposite of me. She blocked out anything traumatic that ever happened to her. And I always wished that that was me because the pictures that stuck with me was one of the hardest things to get through. But I ended up having an experience that happened at school that was nowhere near as bad for me as it was for the other little girls. Boy was pushing girls in the bathroom and doing stuff to them. He tried to get me into the bathroom. So I ended up in, our counselors at the time were amazing. And they pulled all of us girls that had had something happen to us into a room. And they started passing around a ball and letting us speak whatever we wanted to say about however we were feeling. And I remember feeling so bad because what the other girls had gone through was so much worse with that individual than what I had gone through. But I was handling it, I felt like, worse because it brought back everything that had happened to me when I was little.
Yeah. How could you not just carry that? How long after the incident with your uncle was this in school?
So this would have been about 3 years.
Oh, yeah. So then you're even an even more awkward age and
very
stage
awkward
of life. You've gone from a little girl to now you're not quite a young woman, but you're,
Yeah,
that's a difficult thing.
My counselor had a really close relationship with me and my assistant principal, and they could kind of always tell when something was off with me. My family had moved me from West Haven to Brigham City at that time, and I wasn't handling the move very well and leaving my friends very well, and then going through the trying to process the sexual violence that I had been through. And so my counselor knew that there was more than just what had happened at school. So she took me out of the room into her office, and she gave me a timeline, basically. I ended up telling her what happened to me. She was the first adult I had told. I had told two of my friends. And so she gave me a timeline. She said, we're going on Christmas break. You have to tell your mom what happened to you before we come back. And she said, I'm telling you this because I love you. If you don't, I'm going to call Child Protective Services because you're being forced to be around the person who victimized you and abused you. I also always had a hard time around the holidays because I knew our family was so close. I knew I was going to be with them for Thanksgiving and Christmas Eve. And so I agreed. I said I would tell my mom.
Did the abuse only happen the one time with his uncle, his past uncle?
Yeah. So where he actually did the act was once. Mm-hmm. He groomed me for a long time. He did other things after. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember after the abuse happened, I was never afraid of him before the abuse. Like, he was almost like a second dad to me. I spent a ton of time with him, with his family. But after the abuse, I was terrified of him. And he liked that. I would try to go around a different side of my grandma's table when we're all leaving because my family was very affectionate. And I knew he was going to kiss me when we were leaving. So I would try to get away or get out of it. One time he came up to our house in Brigham City, and he came down to my bedroom by himself to actually go through like music. He wanted to play a Tupac song for me. And I'll never forget it because it was so weird because it was me and him in my bedroom. And he flirted with me a lot. And I didn't realize that's what it was then. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of trying to get through how uncomfortable I was around him after that. But when we were looking back on things, I used to babysit all the time. Like, his daughters were my life. My cousins, like, I was so close to them, and I used to babysit them a lot. And my mom said after the sexual violence happened, instead of getting excited when my aunt or he would ask me to come over or babysit, I would say that I was sick. And I would tell my mom that I was starting to feel sick. I remember we were at a steakhouse one time and they wanted me to go home with them for the weekend, which would have been completely normal before. I spent a lot of weekends with my aunt. But I started telling my mom that I was sick. And I was so scared. When I finally told my mom, I was so scared to tell my mom. And I think I knew I prepped myself. I told my counselor, I'm going to tell them because you're making me. I only had one brother. He is my life. You're going to pull me away from my brother if I don't tell my mom. So I'm going to tell them, but nobody is going to believe me. He's a very charismatic man. And kids gravitated to him. They loved him. So I knew that no one was going to believe me. That's what I went into it thinking, was that no one was going to believe me. So I told my mom, and my mom will tell you she believed me from the beginning. But in my head, where I was at, I definitely didn't feel like she believed me. And she went down to tell my aunt what I had said happened to me. And my aunt said, I believe her. And the reason I believe her is because he was arrested for the two neighbor girls. Oh. And none of us knew. You got to remember, this is a time before cell phones, mm-hmm. before the internet, before we had instant connection with each other. Nobody knew that he had been arrested. The timeline of when I told my family is so crazy that he had been arrested and no one knew. Well, that set off a whole different chain of events for me because I had babysat those neighbor girls. I knew that they were 3 and 5. I knew that they were little. And I don't think I expected to feel I expected to feel relief, and I felt such a deep sense of responsibility and regret. Immediately my brain, I'm 12, is saying, you didn't say anything. So these two little girls had what happened to me happen to them because you didn't say anything. And I took that on for a really long time, a really long time. I had spent most of my teenage years planning my suicide. I knew I wanted to die. I knew I couldn't keep living with the responsibility I felt for the other girls. On top of that, my parents chose not to press charges because I love my parents. Just want to say I love my parents. But in their mind, they were saving me from having to tell my story to police officers in front of a judge and possibly I remember my dad saying, they do everything they can to discredit you. And now I look at that statement and it's something that's been said over and over and over and over again. Because for parents, it puts this fear in them of this is what my child's going to go through. But if you have a perpetrator saying that to you for a victim, it puts this fear in of now I'm going to be victimized all over again because they're not going to believe me. They're going to spend time ripping me apart and discrediting me. Oh, yeah. Why would I want to go through that?
Right.
You just stay quiet instead.
I really wanted to go through that. I mean, I think the biggest mistake that my parents made is that they did not press charges because I knew what he did was wrong. I also knew at that time that having so many charges can put you away and throw away the key. And so I really wanted to press charges. I really wanted to speak up for myself. And my parents chose not to. My family is very, very private and pretty much decided that okay, we know what happened now. It's out there. Now we're not going to talk about it again. That's it. And, you know, what they didn't realize is I'm 12 to probably 15, and I'm feeling deep, like, I am responsible for these other two little girls.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm 15, and I'm starting to like boys, and anytime someone touches me, I'm physically sick. Mm-hmm. I can't be affectionate with someone. I had a hard time even, like, holding hands, like, kissing, like, took me right back to the room. Touching me took me right back to the room. So I'm suffering in silence because my family feels so much regret and responsibility over it, and they really just don't want to talk about it again. In everyone's mind, I feel like it was, he's gone. He's in prison for what he did to these other little girls. So now it's time to move on. But I was never moving on from that night. So at 15, I decided I couldn't do it anymore. And I took every pill I could find in my mom's medicine cabinet. I just didn't want to have any more nightmares about the night. I didn't want to picture the night anymore. I just really wanted to go to sleep and never have to go through it again. And so my brother came down. He was 5 years younger than me, to my room. He was still is one of my best friends, but he was my everything. And I realized right then and there, like, this is who's going to find me. And then what have I just done? I've hurt another kid.
Mm-hmm.
And caused irreparable damage. And so I ran up to my mom. I told my mom what I did. You know, we got my stomach pumped and everything else. But still, at that point, I was like, I really need therapy. And still, it's not going to help to talk about this. And I remember...
I wonder if your parents felt that way, because counselors are mandatory reporters. And they just didn't want that legal aspect. They were just so afraid of it for whatever reason.
I think my mom was, the guilt ate my mom alive still to this day. And I can tell anyone, yeah, I realize all the warning signs now, but I would have never guessed. So I wish that that's something my parents, especially my mom, could have let go of, is that guilt that she felt. I think my dad's mentality was, this happens to a lot of girls. And I think society kind of said that. I mean, at that point, it does.
We over-sexualize women, young girls. I mean, from the time they're little, we have, you know, beauty contests for little tiny girls. We're putting makeup on them. We're over-sexualizing them. And it goes throughout our entire lives. And then, unfortunately, men think that that's just the way it is, as if we are objects, but they've been taught that we are an object. And then through grooming of society, we kind of act like we are objects at times.
Yep.
And so it's a complicated, I mean, it's heavy, right? It's a big picture, a long society held beliefs, you know. 100 years ago, it was acceptable. These behaviors.
This just happens. Yep.
You know,
we don't talk about it.
It's just part of life. We need to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to pick up on the story. We're back. Brandy, I just really want to acknowledge you for coming on and talking about this. This is a lot of heavy, deep, emotional wounding and trauma that you had to go through in your life. And it's really brave of you to come out here. This is part of a 3-part series. We've been talking about the Children Justice Centers that are available all throughout the state of Utah and in many other states as well. I think it's so important
that if you have a child who's been sexually abused, or you, if you even think they've been sexually abused, to be able to make a report and get into a justice center where an evaluation, a forensic interview, any medical exams can happen in a safe and nurturing environment that is set up for the child. This story is heartbreaking because you literally have two parents that I am sure absolutely love you. And yet it was easier for them to protect the perpetrator and the family status quo, the family system, than it was to be uncomfortable with what the fallout would be from not anything you did, but the person who acted out against you. It's really sad, but I would like to say it's a shocking story to hear, but unfortunately, we hear these stories all the time. And women, when they're 18, 19, 20, 30, 40 sometimes, that haven't processed this kind of sex abuse and trauma, that eventually you have to process it because it keeps you from being able to fully enjoy your life, your sex life, your emotional connection, your relationship with a partner, so many aspects. So you were sharing with us about your mom and her, you know, their need to continue on with this, we don't need to report. How does it finally come together? How do you finally stand up for yourself?
So I had, like I said, every intention of committing suicide. I knew it was going to happen. My grandma, who was my best friend in the world, was dying of cancer, and I knew that I was just going to go when she did. That was always my plan. But I met my husband about a year. I guess it was about 11 months before my grandma died. I met my husband, and he was a huge part in pulling me away from the suicide part temporarily. And then about a month after my grandma died, I found out I was pregnant with my daughter. And that was it. I wasn't going to do anything to myself. I was going to protect this person that I loved so much from the second I found out. And that was going to be my thing. I was going to get through it. I was going to protect her. And I was going to just try to put it behind me. The difficult thing is, though, I would have moments with my husband that it would still just come right back. And it was constant. And then I was almost crazy protective with my daughter, to the point where people couldn't even really hold her because of what I was also dealing with, of being so afraid. My daughter and my son are 14 months apart. They never spent a night somewhere else until they were 5 and 4, and that was just at my mom's house. And my younger three, same thing. I had this deep need to protect them. So I feel like I kind of turned everything into being a mother, mm-hmm. which really worked until it didn't. Mm-hmm. Until, you know, I started having situations where my daughter was like 6 and she was like, "Mom, everyone else gets to go to so-and-so's house after school and you won't let me. Like, you've got to let go a little bit." And so then I kind of I went to a therapist. I started processing what had happened. We started calling it what it really was, because for a long time it was, you know, there's no difference in the terms of sexual violence and sexual abuse and molestation and rape. But my therapist really believed if you're not calling it what it actually was, then you're not going to get through it. So I explained that I was molested several times, but I hadn't said what actually happened. I finally told my therapist what actually happened. And then I thought I was doing really good. I had mentally prepared myself with a therapist to see this man at my cousin's wedding. I knew that it would be the first time that I saw him. And I thought I was really prepared. And I was. I went to the wedding. She's one of the most important people in my life. I can't miss this because of him. But I don't know how it's going to go seeing him. I stayed as long as I could handle it. I had my kids. I had my family around me, my parents right with me. And then I left with my kids and thought, okay, you just made a huge, that's a huge, you know, progress. That's so much progress for you. So what I wasn't expecting was the following weekend, I was invited to something and told he wouldn't be there. And they really, I mean, who told me he wouldn't be there? That really she believed he wouldn't be there. He wasn't invited there. But he walked in to that party like he owned the room. And like eye contact with me. And I've got my two little girls that are the same age as I was in that room with the same man that took everything from me at that age. Mm-hmm. My daughters are two of the happiest little kids you'll ever see. And I'm looking at them thinking, that's how old I was. So I'm frantic. I mean, there's no calm like there was at the wedding. I'm frantic to get my girls and get them out of there. And I get in the car and I get a block away and then I have to pull over. I can't even see. I mean, it's like everything is black. I can't breathe. It was the worst panic attack I've ever had. I had panic attacks when I was a little girl after I had gone through this, but it was nothing like that. Having my daughters in there, feeling like I couldn't protect them and I couldn't protect myself was, even though I knew there's a lot of other people there, there's family, nothing's going to happen. It didn't matter. There was no rational side of me in that moment. It was, here I am looking face to face with the man that has affected so many aspects of my life, the way I am, the way my childhood was, the starting to have to keep secrets, the, you know, way I am as a mother, the way I am as a wife, the way I was as a girlfriend. Like, and he can just walk in this room and look me right in the face. It was like so much panic that turned into so much anger in such a short amount of time. And so once I calmed down that night, I went to my husband and I said, I'm going to go to the police department tomorrow. And he's like, okay, let's talk through this. You know, my daughter Mackenzie is incredibly intelligent and she is like, Mom, this is 20 years later. I mean, longer than that. And, you know, is this really what you want to do? Because you didn't go get a rape kit. You didn't do some of these things. Are you sure this is what you want to do? And my husband said, do it. You go to the police department and you report it. Maybe it does nothing. Maybe it does something for you. I don't know. But you do what you feel like you have to do. I went to work the next day. I was a mess all day at work on the following Monday. And then I left work early and I got in my car and I called South Ogden Police Department. I said, I'm 36 years old. I want to report a rape when I was 8. Can you have someone talk to me? And that was the very first time in all of it that I ever felt like I had turned some sort of a corner, like I was actually starting to heal. I have to give so much credit to the detective in South Ogden because I'm in this room with him. And you have to give explicit detail about what happened to you. And I'm doing that because I'm just mad at this point. And I keep saying to him, I know this is probably hard to believe, or I know that I didn't do this, or I know it didn't get reported. And he finally stopped me and he said, Brandy, stop. You tell me exactly what happened and you don't have to plead any case. You don't have to do that. You don't have to tell me, like, say you're sorry, because mm-hmm. I kept saying I was sorry. I felt like, at first, I felt like I was wasting his time. And he was so, so good to explain to me that this is happening a lot, that there are more and more victims like me that have not been able to get through what happened to them that are coming forward. And I did tell him, I said, you know, I really want people to understand that they can report it at any time. And even if nothing happens for them, they might prevent someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Because my understanding is my perpetrator had many, many victims. Most,
of course, yeah.
Yeah, most he wasn't charged for.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted, at that point, when I walked out of that police department, it was so weird. I had done so much therapy. I had done so much work. I had done so much counseling. But walking out of that police department, I was like, I just took my life back. I just took my life back. And so that was kind of the full circle. And I got to go home. You know, my kids know what happened to me. A lot of people think I told them too young or something. I didn't give a ton of detail, but mm-hmm. they know what to do if something like this happens. They know what a perpetrator will tell them. They know all the threats that will be used against them if something like this happens. And so I got to go home and look at them and say, I stood up for myself. I got to tell my sons I stood up for myself, and it's never acceptable for someone to do this to someone else, and it should just be brushed under a rug, because he would probably tell you, I served my time. And I will tell you, I've never stopped serving his time for what he did to me.
That is a powerful statement right there. We had another guest on, and she was basically saying kind of a similar thing, but you articulated it so well. The penalties, once somebody acts out against a child or a woman for that matter, or it could be a boy or a man, those penalties are emotional trauma that from the moment it happens changes one's mental direction for the rest of your life. What do you feel the fallout has been for you? What is the changes you've seen in yourself since claiming your voice back by being able to state, this did happen and I am speaking up about it?
I think relationships within my family changed, and that has been really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely say that's the fallout. I have anger that I still have to work on that I feel towards every adult that was part of that equation. I give my mom so much credit because she has put in more work than anybody else on changing everything about her mentality around it and listening to me. And so I feel like that was something that came out of it that was really strong and good, as I got to forge a better relationship with my mom and actually be able to openly talk about what happened to me. I'm a different person. I am so much stronger. I can talk about what happened to me openly without feeling guilt. And I think one of the biggest turns for me, too, is that when anyone in my family would try to, I guess, kind of lighten what was done, I've been able to, like, stop them and say, no, actually, this is what happened, or this is what happened. And I don't tell you guys that to hurt you guys. I tell you guys that because it's not fair to me to water down what he did to me. And for a long time, that's what it felt like, was I remember getting told, you have to understand someone was doing this to him as a child. And when you're told, you have to understand that, and I'm already a really compassionate person, I started to feel sympathy for my abuser, which I did not realize how much damage that can
do
to a person. Yeah. Because then when I'm looking at my own kids going, okay, wait, but this happened to me, and what it did to me growing up, I would never inflict that kind of pain on another human being ever, but you want me to say that because it happened to him, I am supposed to have sympathy for him. And that was a huge moment for me where I really feel like I turned a corner, because I went from, this is what everyone expects of me, or this is how I should be, or I should feel, you know, this way towards him or give him some sort of grace, to, oh no, I don't actually have to do that. No, I don't have to do that. Because see, when I go to bed with my husband 7 nights a week and can't have him even touch me sometimes because the first thing I think of is him, mm-hmm. I don't have to give him grace. I don't have to give him compassion. I don't. And that's when I started to really feel like mentally I started to turn a corner, you know, where it wasn't just me at that point living for my kids, which is what I had been doing. I'd been living for my kids, to I was actually living for Brandy.
Right. Well, there's so much shame that happens in living with this kind of trauma, and that self-shame is so detrimental to our mental well-being. And it's not okay to live our lives for our children or for someone else. We have to be able to make peace with ourselves at some point and be able to truly love ourselves. But if what we've taught is that we're not even valuable enough to stand up for or own a particular situation, it's just really damaging. I'm so sorry you've had to go through this. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Brandy, this has been emotional, and I've watched you as you've shared your story, and still the pain comes up, which is normal. It's a part of living with this situation. How are you doing today, and what happened to the perpetrator? As the 36-year-old who reported this, did something happen to him in your case?
So I've called a couple of times. I believe it's ongoing. I don't have any indication on whether or not they're going to press charges. I've definitely turned a corner from the situation. I had to make peace with whatever happened, whether mm-hmm. they pressed charges or they didn't press charges. I had to make peace with that, because mm-hmm. at that point I really had done everything I could possibly do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, day by day trying to work through stuff with my husband, because I would say that that's the relationship that's definitely affected the most, is the relationship with my husband and the relationship with my dad. So it's kind of working on that every day. And I'm still really protective of my kids. That's not going to go away. But I think having open conversations with them about my life and things that happen to me and things that they can do and watch out for has helped me a lot. My daughter's 19, and so she's getting ready to leave home, and she's at college, and I feel like I've prepared them as much as I can, and I hope I'm setting a good example for them by standing up for myself and trying to do something good from how bad it was.
Yeah. Well, for sure, I'm confident that they feel like if they found themselves in a similar situation, you'd be advocating and supporting them through that process. And I think that that's really important, that they know that they have a safe place, a mother who understands and would understand with love and compassion for what they had gone through. Brandy, before we go, tell me, what does resilience mean to you?
Oh. Sometimes it's throwing out everything that I knew about what I was going through and how I dealt with it and starting over and just trying to, okay, that didn't work. I tried that route of counseling or that route of talking through things or whatever, and that didn't work. So now I'm going to go and try something else. For me, that's what it's been like, regularly for me, I've had to try every single thing that is out there, every resource that's available, to then pick myself back up and keep going. I used to tell myself that whatever happened to me, there's a million people out there that it's way worse for. They had so much worse abuse. They went through it more than one time. And I think that that's a really important thing for resilience. But I also think we have to be really careful about doing that, because mm-hmm. it diminishes in a way what we went through.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of makes you feel guilty for feeling the, like, on the really rough days.
Yeah, it doesn't actually really matter. We tend to do this in society, right? Like, Jenny and I are both widows. We lost our husband. Jenny might go, oh, well, she had it way worse because she knew her husband was dying for 22 months. And I could say, oh, Jenny had it way worse because he was taken immediately. And so we kind of do this. We evaluate or mark trauma or experiences as
comparisons.
And really,
almost like it's a competition,
right,
of who's got it worse. Or when in reality, I love what you're saying, Brandy, that we can't diminish what's difficult for us. And I think the perfect example I use is, like, my husband did die. That was fairly traumatic. But before that and since that, I've had other difficult things happen that mm-hmm. you could say pale in comparison. But in the moment, they didn't feel pale in comparison. And I might look back now and say, oh, man, the 28-year-old me that was so worried about such and such had no idea what death would look like. But that's not the point. The point is it was difficult, whatever it was. So I appreciate you mentioning that we can have compassion and awareness that everyone mm-hmm. has hard things in life. But the real crux of it is, if what you're going through is hard, that's hard. You don't have to justify it, explain it, compare it. It's not a competition. Can we all just accept the fact that what we're going through is hard? And my heart is my heart, and that's enough. I don't have to worry about where it fits on a scale compared to your difficult thing.
And you don't need to feel guilty if your hard is getting out of bed that morning versus someone else's hard.
Right. And there's people that really struggle with depression, and they've never been sexually abused. They have a good job. They really have, by all accounts, everything going well for them in their life, but they may really struggle with just the ability to get out of bed. And and we can't really judge that. And that's the whole point of this podcast. We want to just put the message out there that we need to give each other a little bit more room and space, and to understand that we don't have the same perspectives. We all have different upbringings, different life experiences, different family systems, different religions, a lot of things. But ultimately, we all end up, nobody gets out of here doing some really hard things. And so just to be more compassionate. Yeah. So I love that you brought that up. Thank you for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you for being so vulnerable with us. I mean, I'm sitting just a couple of feet from you, and my heart just hurts to see the emotion in your face and hear it in your voice as you speak. But I'll tell you, there was something beautiful when you said, when you shared the part about you walked out of the police office, I took my life back. Like, I saw that in you. I saw it in your physical stature. And that doesn't mean mm-hmm. you don't revisit it and it's not difficult. But to me, that was a moment of resilience where it didn't come down to the judge threw him in prison the rest of his life, or the cop said this or that. It was you. The action you took for you empowered you to at least be able to turn that corner. It's still a difficult road, but you could turn that corner. And that was just such a physical example to me as I watched your body kind of say, like the Rocky in me, I'm taking my life back. So thank you for that courage.
Jenny and Brandy, that's why I thought this story was so important. So important for the show is it's less about whatever a court
what justice
or judge
did or, didn't
or what
do.
Justice does.
Yeah.
That's kind of a side point. The important thing is to listen and allow our children's voices to be heard.
Or your own voice if you're the one needing to voice that.
Absolutely.
That you advocated for yourself when you were in a position to advocate for your children long before you found the voice for yourself. And I think sometimes we do that as parents too. But thank you for joining us. Just a big hug and all the love and respect in the world for the woman that you are and the path that you're now on. And we've learned a lot today. To our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this difficult conversation. Like Michelle said, this is another in our three-part series about these critical conversations that unfortunately we don't have often enough, not because they're not issues, but because we just don't want to have the conversation. So I wish they weren't issues so we never had to talk about these terrible things. But truth is, these terrible things happen. People around us are hurting, one, because of what's happened to them, but even more so maybe because they're not being listened to and heard. So let's do all what we can. Everybody listening, anywhere you are in your life, let's make sure we try to be compassionate listeners and willing to be a shoulder for the person that might be struggling with whatever it is, and never try to discount it like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. So thanks for that reminder today. To our listeners, thanks as always for tuning in. We hope you'll go find us on your favorite podcast platform and give us a like and a rating and a review. That helps us improve the show and also get the word out about the show. And we would love to hear your stories of resilience. So if you're brave enough to take a chance, please reach out to us. You can find us on social media at Relentlessly Resilient. On Facebook, there's a little button. You click on the button on the Relentlessly Resilient Facebook page where you can set up a phone call appointment with Michelle to just talk about what you might talk about as a guest on the show. Really informal. It's like sitting down with friends. And we find that we all learn and grow together when we realize that we're in this together. And so we'd love to have your story be one that we get to share with our listeners.
And remember, whatever you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles others are dealing with in their life. Have a great day.
Take care, everybody.